You know, it's kind of just, I don't know what I'm saying.
Well, all right, welcome back to The Last Week in Medicine.
Hello.
Yeah.
I'm here too. I'm Austin.
So it's December 2nd, 2019. This is our fourth episode. I'm Stephen Jenkins. And like he said,
I'm Austin.
He's Austin.
Austin Rupp.
So we hope you all had a great Thanksgiving, filled with food and football and arguing with your relatives about politics, or at least that you got to go to a nice hospital potluck.
How was that?
Oh, I didn't go.
You didn't contribute. You didn't go. You weren't in a thankful mood.
I left the hospital like around 12.
Nice.
So
we are thankful for all our healthcare team.
Oh, yeah, for sure. How was your Thanksgiving?
It was good. I was with friends, more of a Friendsgiving. And then I skied for a couple days afterwards. 5 feet in 1 week.
Mm.
Epic.
Of a Utah
Narnia,
hospitalist.
Narnia out there.
Narnia.
With a G, obviously.
Yeah, my Thanksgiving was filled with white-knuckle driving on snow-covered roads. So I was making a left turn on my way to the hospital, and I slid into the curb and jacked my alignment. So that was a bummer. And then I went over to my mother-in-law's after work for Thanksgiving dinner, and my wife's grandma told me all about the deep state and how Treasury can't print money anymore, and we're switching back to the gold standard, and that's going to be really great for our economy. So
grandma's know best.
Yeah,
know?
She told
me. Or mother-in-law. Mother-in-law's know best.
No, this was her grandma.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No,
well, they both. Yeah, whatever.
But she told me she gets her news from some guy on YouTube. So
Alex Jones. we're getting dangerous here potentially.
Frightening stuff though.
Okay.
So just a reminder for our listeners, the purpose of this podcast is to help you stay up to date on internal medicine. So every week we're going to share our favorite articles with you from major medical journals. And by way of disclaimer, this is for education purposes, will involve a lot of our own opinions. So you shouldn't base your medical decision making based solely on something you heard on this podcast, i.e. if something bad happens to your patient, we are not responsible. Also, I want to issue a formal apology for some sound issues we had on the last podcast episode. So it turns out we had the microphone set up wrong. So sorry if we were like really quiet and then the music came on and like blew out your car speakers.
And we don't know how this week's going to be either. So I mean,
well, I think we have it set up,
but who knows?
Okay.
We actually don't issue an apology. We just apologize if you felt that the sound was bad.
Oh, okay.
We're not sorry.
I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
So we got some great stuff to talk about today. My first article is from the New England Journal of Medicine. The first author is Dr. Clive Curran, and it's titled Diagnosis of Pulmonary Embolism with D-Dimer Adjusted to Clinical Probability. So we all know about using the Wells score to stratify patients according to low, moderate, or high-risk probability for a PE. So if a patient is low or moderate risk and you get a D-dimer and it's not more than 500 nanograms per milliliter, then you can rule out a PE in most patients. And if they're high risk, then you usually just get a CT pulmonary angiogram. There have been other variations on this, like the age-adjusted D-dimer, where your upper limit for a D-dimer is derived by multiplying your patient's age by 10. So like an 80-year-old patient can have a D-dimer up to 800 nanograms per milliliter, and that would rule out a PE. But some retrospective studies have also shown that the risk of PE is very low in patients with a low clinical pretest probability up to 1,000 for the D-dimer. So this study that we're talking about decided to test that hypothesis with a prospective trial. So they enrolled 2,000 patients who had signs or symptoms of PE, and they did not really clarify specifically what signs or symptoms. They stratified them with the Wells score into low, moderate, or high probability, and the majority of them were low probability, about 87%. 11% were moderate, and 2.3% were high. And then everyone with a low or moderate pretest probability got a D-dimer. And if it was less than 1,000 and they had low pretest probability, then they did not go any further. No CTPA, no anticoagulation. And 2/3 of the patients with low pretest probability had a D-dimer less than 1,000. And none of these patients had a pulmonary embolism diagnosed in the next 3 months. If the D-dimer was less than 500 with a moderate pretest probability, they did not get further testing, and none of those patients had a PE in the next 3 months. So patients with D-dimers above those cutoffs did undergo CTPA, as did patients with high pretest probability. And all together, there were like 7% of patients in the study ended up getting diagnosed with a PE. Using their algorithm, 34% of patients got a CT scan, whereas if they had used the original algorithm using the lower D-dimer cutoff for the low probability patients, then they would have gotten scans in like 50% of patients. So they did a pretty big reduction in CT scans, which I think is cool.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah, so all but one of the patients was, so I guess all of the patients pretty much were outpatient or in the emergency room. So that's like one issue maybe for us, mm-hmm. since we work in the hospital. Can you use the same algorithm in hospitalized patients? Probably not, but for your fresh admissions coming out of the ER, that can probably be useful. And then another potential weakness was that most of the patients were low probability. So it would have been interesting to see results if they'd been able to recruit more moderate probability patients. Also, the clinicians got to enroll whoever they wanted. And so, you know, it's possible that maybe they were nervous about enrolling some of the moderate and high-risk patients, and maybe that's why most of them were low pretest probability. So anyway, big takeaway, if your patient has a low probability of PE based on a well score and their D-dimer is less than 1,000, you can feel pretty good about not getting a CT scan on them.
Yeah, I think this was a good, you know, well-done study with a sufficient number of patients. A couple of points that I had were that the pretest probability is the starting point here, and that's the, you know, calculated via the Wells score, and that I sometimes find the Wells score to be subjective. I mean, there's, you know, the one portion of it that's like PE is the most likely diagnosis, and, you know, that always trips me up a little bit. There are certainly some objective things on there, but I feel like you can kind of modify the Wells score based on whether or not you want to get the CT scan or not.
Yeah.
Which brings me to the next point of our patients. I just want to know if they have a PE. You know what I mean? I mean, that's probably a lame way to practice in some regards, but I just don't know that this patient population is representative of our patient population, and that if someone comes into the hospital, you know, with signs and symptoms of a PE but has a low well score and a negative D-dimer but is sitting on the floor for 3 days and I have no other explanation and, you know, I want to get the CT scan, sometimes I just get the CT scan.
Well, that's fair. I mean, I think, you know, the nice thing about the CT scan is it's not just looking for clot, right? So maybe there's other issues with their lungs that you're going to find. And in our patient population, you know, older patients, more comorbidities, more likely to have things on their CT scan. So I think if you know, that's reasonable. I think I'm in a lot of our patients too, you know, if you've been in the hospital for a while, you're D-dimer is probably going to be elevated anyway.
Right.
So I think it's still worth checking the D-dimer and seeing if it's negative. I usually feel pretty good about not getting a scan for PE, but maybe I'll still scan their chest, maybe a non-con CT just to look at the lungs.
So. Yeah. So I think those are worth mentioning, as well as the fact that our D-dimer assay uses different units and that needs to be taken into account. I think you just multiply ours by 1,000 or something, right?
Well, yeah, ours comes back as like 0.5 instead of 500.
Right. Okay. So that always trips me up. And then
math is hard.
You know, additionally, we could talk about this on another day, but it seems like PEs have like sort of come in and out of favor, especially in the setting of syncope. You know, that's kind of a microcosm, I think, of like PEs in general. Mm. But, you know, there was that one Italian study that showed really high incidence of PE in unexplained syncope. And then a big meta-analysis came out that was like, no, it's much more like one or, you know, less than 1% probably, or 1-2% across millions of patients with unexplained syncope. So, you know, it's kind of just, I don't know what I'm saying.
Well, no, I do think that is interesting. I think about that in my syncopal patients. Like, is a D-dimer enough to rule out a PE in those folks? Probably is based
Probably
on
is.
This study.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. But anyway, I think it's just kind of funny how things change over time. So Next article, huh? I wanted to talk about a study titled The Association of the Work Schedules of Hospitalists with Patient Outcomes of Hospitalization. So this is very applicable to us as hospitalists. Doctors Goodwin, Lee, and Kuo out of the University of Texas at Galveston did this study, and it was published in JAMA Internal Medicine. I think it bears mentioning that I'm stronger than you and work 12 days in a row.
I'm a weak person.
You are a weak person.
I can only work 7 days in a row.
As long as that's clear, we can move forward. So this study attempted to investigate whether hospitalist schedules impact patient outcomes. Previous data have shown worse outcomes like mortality and readmission rate when patients are cared for in the hospital by hospitalists versus their PCP. But whether or not inpatient continuity, i.e. hospitalist schedules, impact outcomes has not been addressed. So this group was interested in whether continuity as indicated by whether or not hospitalists worked multiple consecutive days was associated with mortality, readmissions, cost, post-discharge, and discharge destination. This was a cohort study that looked at 114, or more like 115,000 patient admissions with a 3 to 6 day hospital stay over 3 years from 229 hospitals in Texas. The hospitalists were then grouped into continuity of care quartiles based on the total number of their working days that were part of a 7 or more consecutive day block. So does that make sense? They sort of divided, like if you work 30% of your job as 7 or more consecutive days, you were that affected what quartile you went into. So as an aside, they found that 28% of hospitalists in Texas had 0 working days as part of a 7 day consecutive block. That seems high. You know, there's probably like 1 or 2 people in our group, or no people in our group that have 0.
Right. Everyone works sevens, at least sevens.
Right. So I think that's probably like nocturnus and stuff like that, but kind of interesting. Anyway, a stepwise association was noted between the quartile of hospitalist schedule continuity and unadjusted and adjusted 30-day mortality. The hazard of readmission also decreased in the highest continuity quartile, and patients cared for by the highest quartile of continuity were also more likely to be discharged home. And then finally, 30-day post-discharge costs decreased as the continuity score increased. A few notes here, I thought. This was all Medicare data, and determining schedules from Medicare data seems pretty fraught with error. And then they acknowledge that there were some significant differences between hospitals and patient characteristics between quartiles, but they did attempt to adjust for that. But overall, patients cared for by hospitalists that more frequently worked multiple consecutive days in a row had lower mortality, lower readmission, and lower post-discharge costs.
Yeah, I mean, those are all pretty important outcomes. So
very.
I think this is something that's like intuitive. Like we assume that if we have longer stretches with patients that they'll have better outcomes. But they actually, you know, devised a way to try to look at that. And the numbers are pretty striking. So I think it would have been interesting if they had like an additional quartile for people that worked like more than sevens, you know, like people working 10, 12, and 14. Because you could almost imagine like a U-shaped curve where things start to get worse at day 14 because they're like exhausted and maybe sloppier. Yeah. I don't know.
I feel like
when I've worked 12 days in a row, like my head is not there anymore. And so like for me, 7 days is like the sweet spot. Mm-hmm, so, but yeah, I know. I think this is an interesting study. Our group has recently switched to like a model where we can, you know, we don't have to work sevens every time. And so every once in a while, you're going to work 3 or 4 days. And, you know, a lot of people don't like that. I don't mind it, but this
patients
paper makes
worse.
Me think, wow, maybe we should only be doing sevens or more.
Yeah, I think so, it has implications for scheduling amongst hospitalist groups. I mean, you're trying to combat competing interests, you know, burnout, lifestyle, et cetera, et cetera. And
so that
needs to be taken into account. But it certainly seems like consecutive days is better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so my next article is from the Journal of General Internal Medicine. The first author is Adrian Brown, PharmD, and the title is Inappropriate Fluoroquinolone Use in Academic and Non-Academic Primary Care Clinics. So they looked at all the outpatient fluoroquinolone prescriptions over a 6-month period in 9 primary care clinics in the Grady Health System. They looked at 4 academic clinics and 5 community-based clinics. Patients were excluded if they had multiple infections or more than two antibiotic allergies. And so they identified 309 prescriptions and were able to include 216 patients in their analysis. And they found that the majority of prescriptions that were inappropriate, 74%, were coming out of the community clinics. The most common indication was cystitis or pyelonephritis. They determined that overall 89% of fluoroquinolone prescriptions were, quote, inappropriate. And so what did inappropriate mean? They had multiple criteria for that. It was considered inappropriate if it met any of the following inappropriate indications. So prescriptions for a diagnosis in which fluoroquinolones are not recommended, or there are other first-line alternatives. Unnecessary, so diagnoses for which there's no indication for antibiotics at all, like bronchitis. Inappropriate duration, so too long, inappropriate dose, or a bug-drug mismatch, like where the pathogen ended up being resistant to fluoroquinolones. So they concluded that overall 95% of the fluoroquinolone prescriptions in the community clinics were inappropriate. It is worth noting that residents overall did better than attendings at not prescribing fluoroquinolones.
I don't believe that.
And they speculate that the reason that prescribing of inappropriate fluoroquinolones was lower academic clinics is because they had more exposure to like antibiotic stewardship programs. And I mean, I think that makes sense to me. Like, I definitely avoid fluoroquinolones in part because I'm like afraid that Emily or Tristan will hunt me down.
They always do.
But I mean, I think it's, really, at least in my practice, like, I don't use fluoroquinolones unless it's like the only oral option that's going to save me from putting a PICC line in someone who like actually needs antibiotics. Like, they have like a, a pyelonephritis mm-hmm. with like a renal abscess or something. Like, I'll happily give that patient a fluoroquinolone. Mm-hmm. But like, I do think that people are still jumping the gun and using them way too much for just like cystitis when Macrobid or Bactrim would do, right?
Yeah, yeah. Agreed. I don't have a heck of a lot to add here. It was a small study. Fluoroquinolones seem to be the low-hanging fruit for antibiotic stewardship. I more or less tell trainees, kind of like echoing what you're saying, Stephen, never use fluoroquinolones. Like, unless you're completely forced to, just don't use
like
them.
Like, the flowchart is like, should I use fluoroquinolones? No.
Right.
That's it. That's, you're done. It's
exactly.
Easy. Yeah. So, no, and I mean, and the side effects, there's all sorts of side effects, right?
Right. I mean, the counter argument would be, they're not, like, we're not making these decisions with these clinicians, and that, they would say probably that you're not there, you don't know what it's like out in the community, and sometimes this is my only choice, but 95% is a pretty striking number.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, so the next article I'd like to discuss is called Utilization and Outcomes of Thrombolytic Therapy for Acute Pulmonary Embolism, a Cohort Study. It's by Dr. Bayer and colleagues from Harvard and has been accepted for publication in Chest. As previously noted, we are thrombosis experts, so this is a particular interest to us. The name kind of jumped out at us, so that's why we're talking about it, but we'll dissect it a little further. Disclaimer, we are not thrombosis experts. It's an inside joke. We'll just leave it at that.
I mean, people call us for thrombosis consults.
It's true. I'm going to frame this a little bit more at the end, but basically these guys use the nationwide readmissions database to evaluate 5,436 admissions for PE that received thrombolysis. They were specifically interested in looking at the differences between systemic thrombolysis and catheter-directed thrombolysis, and then catheter-directed thrombolysis with and without the use of ultrasound. So systemic lytics were used more often than catheter-directed thrombolysis, about 3,400 versus 2,000 patients. And patients that received systemic thrombolysis were sicker. So they had more hypotension, shock, cardiac arrest, vasopressor use, mechanical ventilation, and blood transfusions than the group who received catheter-directed lysis. That makes sense, right? Length of stay was shorter in the catheter-directed lysis group, and bleeding was less common in the catheter-directed lysis group. So 8.7% versus 15% for the bleeding. And then there was additionally a difference in mortality. in-hospital mortality and 30-day readmission rate was lower for catheter-directed lysis than systemic lytics, 4.5% versus 17.1% and 7.3% versus 11.5% respectively. So these guys sort of conclude that systemic lytics remain the most commonly utilized method for lytics in PE. And additionally, to take a step back, that there are no differences between catheter-directed lytics with and without ultrasound. Should have mentioned that before, but they kind of looked at everything, and ultrasound did not really change anything. So still more systemic lytics, no difference with catheter ultrasound versus no ultrasound.
Okay. So what's like the big takeaway from
this
study?
So a few critiques. Less than 16% of their patients were identified as having shock or hypotension. So I think you and I would argue that lytics were potentially inappropriately given in the significant majority of their patients. At our institution, and this varies from institution to institution, we really recommend against giving lytics except in hypotension.
Right.
There are certain situations, and it's obviously always a case-by-case basis, but 16% with shock, hypotension, pressors, et cetera, is a pretty low number, in my opinion. So I think
to be giving lytics.
To be giving lytics, yeah. So I think that's really important to mention.
And it makes sense that the ones who got catheter-directed lytics had, you know, better mortality rates because they were probably not that sick. Right.
Like, they were,
what was the percentage of them that had shock? Like, it was... It's pretty low.
Yeah, pretty low for the catheter-directed lysis.
You know, and this has been looked at, right? Like the PYTHO study, they actually, you know, looked at this kind of intermediate risk population, people that didn't have hypotension, but they had like, you know, evidence of right heart strain, elevated troponin, and they gave them lytics. And in that study, the people that got lytics had way more bleeding episodes, and there was no real difference in mortality. And even in follow-up, they did a PYTHO follow-up study, there really was no big difference in outcomes. So really, there's really not like a great indication for lytics in people who aren't in shock, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. But, and I think, again, that's institution-dependent and varies who you would ask, but here we've sort of adopted that algorithm. I think it's also worth mentioning that the research in this arena is fraught with issues. So there's a lot of secondary sort of surrogate endpoints that are analyzed, you know, echo parameters, thrombus burden, et cetera, that aren't clinically very relevant. You know, we're sort of specifically interested in mortality, maybe functional status, et cetera, but that stuff does not get studied very often. And, you know, there's sort of a upside down incentive here for procedures to get done sometimes, you know, not patient-centered procedures with the lytics and the catheter-directed lytics.
I mean, you see like these PERT teams popping up around the country, and really there hasn't been like improved outcomes with PERT teams, but there's definitely been increased utilization in catheter-directed lytics and thrombectomies and IVC filters and that kind of stuff. So anyway.
So that makes sense. So stay tuned for us. Stay tuned with us for data from our institution regarding this stuff. And that, again, that's why we're interested in this. But to frame it with those caveats and points is important, I think.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's it for today. Thanks for hanging out with us. If you if you enjoyed the podcast, go ahead and give us 5 stars on iTunes. No, whatever.